Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, in the face of looming public health and sustainability issues, we'll explore the intersection of science and politics in the U.S.
But first, can the internet and social networks change power relations? Our next guest says they already are doing that. With trust as the central issue, he says that people with new communication tools are challenging big business, big government, and big media. Rory O'Connor is a writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of the international media firm Global Vision. He is the author of numerous books, including Shock Jocks, Hate Speech and Talk Radio, and Friends, Followers in the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Welcome, Rory O'Connor.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
Some of the statements that you say right up top about how new media are allowing people to bypass state censorship, outpace traditional news organizations, compel corporations to listen and act on their demands, and compel governments to listen. Can you give us examples of each of these?
Well, you know, first of all, the how, you know, as I posit in the book, it's because these new media tools and technologies are deeply disruptive. And, of course, they enable almost anyone to, for the first time in history, produce and distribute news and information very widely and inexpensively and inefficiently, and to create almost instant networks of like-minded people and amplify their voices. So, you know, that's the how of it. And I think, you know, there are examples everywhere. The subtitle of the book, as you know, is How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. So, you know, let's look at the big brands, for example. It wasn't so long ago that the Bank of America, which I think certainly qualifies as a big brand, decided that they were going to raise the debit card charges to people who banked with them. And there was an instant uproar in the social media, and the Bank of America executives were forced to back down in a record period of time. So, you know, that's an example, and there are many, many others. If you look in politics, you know, I'm sitting here in Oakland. I was down in Ogallala Plaza when the Occupy movement on May Day came back with a vengeance, if you will. And I think there are many, many examples, both domestically and obviously on the international front, with the fall of the Mubarak regime in Egypt being the highlight, I suppose. And when it comes to the traditional media, you know, boy, that's almost an old story at this point. Just about everybody knows what's been happening to them, the legacy media brands that have, you know, really lost vast swaths of their audience and lost the trust of their audience, most importantly. You know, one of the things I look at in the book is how the Gallup organization has been polling Americans about their trust of the media over time. And you know, back in the 1970s, more than 75% of the American people indicated they had a high level of trust in the traditional media. Those figures are now below 25%. So I think in those areas and many, many more. You know, education, of course, is one of the other areas that's about to be disrupted in a big way. So my message beyond the big media, big politics, and big business is that if you are in a sector of our economy or our culture that has yet to be disrupted by these emerging media, just wait.
Well, a couple of things I'd like to back up of what you said. One is you talked about how people are losing trust in the mainstream media. Don't you also think that the concerted effort by certain political provocateurs, for lack of a better word, their concerted campaign against what they called the liberal media through the 90s and early 2000s, do you think that that actually whittled down the trust in media ahead of time?
No, I don't. I don't think that this is a political response, because I find that people on the right and on the left, one of the few things they seem to share these days in our highly polarized political situation here in the United States, is a distrust of the mainstream media. I would say that it's mainly because of poor performance over time. In other words, it's because the legacy media have demonstrated repeatedly that they simply are not worthy of their trust to the audience any longer.
And then at the same time, it sounds like they've built trust in other media institutions. For example, you mentioned Comedy Central.
Well, yes, exactly. Back in the day, in the 20th century, when we had an old, centralized, and a lot more hierarchical media system, you know, there were only three networks, for example, and they basically told you the same news at the same time every day. And there was a fellow named Walter Cronkite, who was then rated as by far the most trusted journalist in the country. And he would end his newscast by saying, well, that's the way it is. And what we find now is that we're in a world where the old centralized, hierarchical, non-participatory forms, you know, no longer apply. And you mentioned Jon Stewart. Over that 40 years that Gallup has been trusting things, the most trusted journalist in America has gone from being the anchorman of CBS News to being, and I don't mean this in a derogative or pejorative way, but to being a self-avowed clown in the person of Jon Stewart.
And at the same time, the traditional media are increasing some of their audiences by using these same internet, social networking, YouTube. There's a merging going on. While they're maybe losing listeners and viewers on one hand, they're gaining them on the other. How do we make sense of this?
The way to make sense of it is to realize, well, first of all, that we literally are in the midst of a revolution. We're actually right at the beginning of a revolution, to put it better. And it's a revolution that's on a par with the Gutenberg Revolution. Obviously, that's a truism, but it's true nonetheless. So, you know, revolutions are very chaotic affairs. They're messy. No one, you know, they go up, they go down. There are winners, there are losers, there is conflict. And that's the situation we're in now. Now, generally speaking, now specifically to your point, my position vis-a-vis traditional journalists, traditional media and social media is that those entities that rather than sticking their heads in the sand, ostrich-like, and just hoping that it all goes away, they actually try to engage that, embrace them, if you will thrive. And those that do not simply will not survive. And I look at two entities in the book in some detail, ABC News and NBC News, and talked extensively to the people who headed the digital news operations there. You know, the fellow at ABC News basically almost left the room when I asked him why we should trust ABC News. He was almost incensed, and his answer was, well, because we're ABC News. Whereas the fellow at NBC News said that his strategy was that NBC News wants to be your friend. And what he meant by that is exactly what you're saying, that they would extend their news into all sorts of platforms, social as well as traditional. And also he made the point that one of the things that they did that was not at all in their experience was to link out to many other forms of media and news and information, including to their competitors at ABC, for example. And I can tell you, in the old days, that is something you would never dream of doing. But in this new media economy, that actually helps to build trust with your audience, because you're saying, you know, as a friend, if you will, as a trusted referral of news and information, I at NBC News want to be your go-to place where you can literally get all the information that you need, even if it comes from somebody that is supposedly a competitor to me.
So a few aspects. One is the issue of trust. And you wrote about how brands were traditionally how people developed trust. It was kind of this familiarity, and how that is changing now. At the same time, we are losing our traditional gatekeepers, or have lost, I should say. And that's a bit of a double-edged sword from what I see. For example, Andrew Breitbart used to doctor videos, put them up on the web, perform these sting operations, destroyed people's livelihoods from these videos that were really not true, and yet people saw them and believed them.
Well, some people did, but you know, a lot of people realized after the first couple of instances that when news came of, you know, the latest, and you're referring in part to James O'Keefe, you know, the conservative so-called investigative reporter who would do these stings and scams against, you know, outfits like Acorn. Now, after it was revealed that there were great flaws, if you will, to put it mildly, in the so-called journalism that he was practicing, well, you know, the second or third time after that had happened, a lot of people just went, oh, you know, that's the same old thing, and it turned out not to be true in the past. So, you know, you're absolutely right about trust being the essence of any relationship. You can't have a friendly relationship with someone that you don't implicitly trust. Also, if you think about a brand essentially is a trust relationship. In other words, what does a brand mean? It means that, for example, in the days of the big brands, Coca-Cola, probably the biggest brand in the world. And what did that mean? I mean, you could trust that wherever you went in the world, almost 200 countries, when you would buy a Coca-Cola, you would get the same thing. You would know what it would be. There aren't 180 different versions of Coca-Cola. So that is the essence of what we meant by a brand. Now, what I posit in the book is that the meaning of brand is now being stretched in an era where we're all told we need to create our own personal brands, and in an era where curators are coming in and replacing some of the old legacy brands and becoming micro brands. And at a certain point, if everyone has a brand, then the word brand, at least in the old meaning of it, no longer really applies. But I would say that trust is the central issue that unites all the observations in my book, whether it's about the media itself, and as I said, we've learned not to trust the legacy media, whether it's about big politics, now that the politicians are making their own media and sending it to us and bypassing the legacy media, well, how much of that can we trust? And then certainly we've seen over time that many of the brands, not only legacy media brands, but corporate media brands and the new media brands, including Facebook's and Google's of the world, we've got to question, you know, how much we can trust them as well. You know, Facebook and Google have repeatedly compromised the privacy of their users. You know, Google with Street View was capturing people's private information without telling them. They first denied that they were doing it. They later said it was a mistake. So this is not trustworthy behavior. And, you know, one of the points I make in the book is that if Facebook and Google continue to violate the trust of their users over time, as shocking as it may sound today, those brands could well be highly damaged and go away as well.
Let's talk about other effects. One is social classes. Do you have a sense that, because access is growing, do you have a sense that classes are being impacted? Is it a bridge or is it a divider?
I think what's happening is that things are flattening and democratizing, and so that's at least potentially a very good thing. And you know, we're seeing a lot of growth in internet usage, for example, in minority communities, in the black community, in the Hispanic community. And particularly with the advent of the smartphone, you're seeing actually much higher adoption rates within these communities that, were just a few years ago, we were worrying about a digital divide and how they may not have sufficient access to the internet because, you know, talking about class, you know, not everybody can afford to have a computer of their own or sitting at their home. But we now find that not only with social coming to dominate, but with mobile coming to dominate, there's been a big switch in that. So I do think that there is a flattening, if you will, a democratization, where more and more people who had been excluded in the past now at least have the opportunity to not only to redistribute other news and information, but to create their own and distribute that.
And what about the balkanization effect? Again, is it uniting or is it dividing in terms of where we go and what we watch and what we listen to and read?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. A whole chapter on this in the book, which is called The Daily Me versus The Daily We. I must say, first of all, this is a subject of great controversy and debate. My own take on it is that we are actually not in as great a danger of this balkanization, this polarization, this reinforcement, if you will, of what we already think, which in, you know, academic terms is called homophily. In other words, you know, love of the same. Are we getting just more of the same and have our own prejudices backed up rather than learning new things. There is a danger of that, absolutely. There's a couple of dangers of it. One is with real-world social networks offline, which are relatively small and largely comprised of your family and your friends. Well, yes, there is a tendency within those to, because those people are much more like us than others, that, you know, we would hear the same sort of news and information. But one of the main points in my book is that the online social networks differ greatly from these real-world social networks. They have unique characteristics that, in fact, work in the opposite way. You know, if I have 1,000 or more friends, quote-unquote, on Facebook, obviously, these are people that I have looser ties with than my family. But I think it's equally obvious that I'm probably going to be exposed to more diverse news and information as a result, not only of the greater number, but of the variety of people. So I think that that is what's happening with the online social networks in that area, and that's one of the reasons why we don't need to fear that. Now, there is another problem that I must mention, which is that of so-called personalization. And this is something that Eli Pariser, for example, has highlighted, and he wrote a book called The Filter Bubble, where he expressed concern about, let's say, Facebook or Google personalizing the news and information that you get. So, for example, you know, if you were to go on Google and I go on Google and we enter the same search terms, we would probably get different results. Because these both Google and Facebook are now reacting to what they know and learn about us from our online behavior, and then trying to, you know, express that in a personalized way. But there, you know, you can shut those off. For example,
can you actually shut those off?
And you just go into the settings in Facebook or in Google. It's really not that difficult, but. Really, I do feel that both of those entities should do a lot more to make these things easier for people. Because even though it's not that difficult, you know, I just saw a piece today that about 30% of all the people on Facebook actually never go into the settings and exert any control over who's seeing what's on their site, over their privacy, over what news and information they're getting. I think that if you could create an entity such as Google and Facebook, you ought to be able to come up with a way to make it very transparent to people how they can control what news and information they're getting.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we are speaking with Rory O'Connor about his new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future. In terms of social classes and polarization, balkanization, do you have a sense at all about ethnicity and religion, and whether this Facebook friending and Googleization is acting as a bridge or a divider?
Well, you know, of course, there are many, many other social networks, and, you know, some of them, I mean, Black Planet, for example, you know, essentially a Facebook for African Americans, you know, Eons, a Facebook for baby boomers. There are many, many different social networks, and there are more every day, many of them in these narrow niches. There's even one called Pair, which is to have a social network between you and one other person, if you could believe that. So there's almost, at this point, an infinite variety. A lot of people I know are involved in more than one social network. You probably want to have a presence on Facebook just because of the so-called network effect, and that means that there's already 900 million people there. But you may well want to have a more specific one in a more narrow area that works for you either, as you say, in terms of your class or your ethnicity or whatever. And I think that, you know, this is wonderful that there's a great variety out there that people can choose to participate in.
And why do you think an outfit like Facebook has outlasted the others, the MySpace, the Friendster, and why it's trumping in some ways Google?
I could tell you about MySpace because MySpace, for two reasons. One, MySpace always conceived of itself as a media company and really not as a social network. And then the second thing is, of course, they were purchased by the legacy media in the person of Rupert Murdoch and a news corporation for more than, you know, $500 million, and they really didn't know how to run it. And, you know, I think the worth of MySpace at this point is probably about $30 million. So, you know, they lost almost $500 million on MySpace largely because they didn't know what they were doing. So I guess the answer is that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg had a better idea of what he was trying to create, which was not a media company, but really was a social network. Now, in terms of Google, that's a whole other, and I would say probably a lot more interesting question. And it really has to do with this vast paradigm shift that's happening now in the way that we access news and information. You know, Google was obviously revolutionary in the first part of the first decade of the 21st century, revolutionizing through its remarkable search engine how people access news and information. But we're now moving very rapidly into a world where social is replacing search as a focus of online activity. Again, I have a whole chapter on Google in my book, and one of the things I say is that, you know, if you are a search engine company in the social world, you know, that's probably a bad place to be. And Google knows this, which is why they have repeatedly over time, almost since their inception, you know, made forays into social. They bought Friendster, for example. They had a social early, and still have, but it was an early social network named Orkut, which was at one time the leading network in Brazil and India, but it's now been surpassed by Facebook. They later started the disastrous Google Buzz, and of course now they're back with Google Plus. So they understand the need to transition into social. They just may not have the corporate DNA to be able to do it.
So in terms of what we're facing now, and you've gave some really great numbers in the book, and they're probably even outdated as we speak, but something
they
like...
They are. I mean, not to interrupt, but my YouTube chapter is called 48 Hours a Minute, which is a reference to the amount of video that was loaded onto YouTube. We've already up to 60 hours a minute.
And this is exactly what I wanted to lead into. Given the morass of data being uploaded, not just YouTube, but on all of these multiple sites, this vast internet, how are people going to sort through, A, fact from fiction? We talked about that a little bit, but also to find the material that might either be A, excellent, or needed. How do people sort through this?
You know, that is the essential question before us now, is how can we find what I call trustworthy or reliable or even credible information when there's literally a tsunami of news and information washing over us, inundating us, and that we're drowning in. So how can we keep from drowning, and how can we separate the signal from the noise? That's the number one issue. Look, we all need shortcuts. Even professional journalists, you know, such as you and I, need shortcuts and filters because the volume is so great. And I posit that there are at least four that people should, you know, investigate and put together as a mix, as a way of at least beginning to deal with the problem. So just very quickly, first of all, the social media themselves, these emerging new networks such as Facebook and Twitter and YouTube itself and so on, I think that's the number one driver, where we can get trusted referrals of news and information from friends and followers, people that we have a relationship with over time. And Facebook is now the leading driver of traffic through the links that are circulated by friends and Facebook to even the legacy news media sites. It's now surpassed Google in search. So that's number one filter, I would suggest, the social media and your friends and followers, you know, hence the title of my book. Now, secondly, there's the rise of the curator, the individual or group of individuals who focus in a sort of a narrow, let's say, vertical information area, let's say the environment. One of the fellows I interviewed in the book was Rob Stewart, and unfortunately passed away. But prior to that, Rob, in my circles, was the go-to guy for good information about the environment, because he was the pack rat. He got it all. He sorted through it. He told us what was important, what was trustworthy, and what was not. And over time, as we get information from these curators who are aggregating all this other information and kind of sorting it for us, you know, the best will rise, more people will come to them, and they, in fact, will become micro brands unto themselves. The third one I want to point to, and I must say this is one I had a bias against, is the algorithm, the recommender systems, you know, these learning machines that we can interact with, and over time they learn about not only what we like, but what we need and what we want. And I said I was biased against them. One, I didn't know that much about them. And two, look, if you go on Amazon or something, how do they work now? You buy something and they come on and they offer you like four more things like it. But when I went out and talked to the top tech people and the top academic researchers in the field, to a person, they told me, well, this will change. The machines are only in their infancy, and they will get much more sophisticated over time as we interact with them, and that they will play a much bigger role in the future in helping to, you know, provide us with valuable information. And then finally, you know, even though they are dinosaurs, you know, the legacy media still exists, and they're still very large and very powerful and still rampaging over the earth. You know, again, people need to choose. Some people think the New York Times is highly reliable. Other people disagree, and they think Fox News is. So what I say is put together a mix of these four elements that works for you and, you know, adjust it over time. If the legacy media piece of it stops working well, look for other outlets that are more trustworthy. If your curator is sending you bad information, there are other places you can go. But we need to have these filters and shortcuts to help us.
Rory O'Connor, that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The name of the book is Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media and Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands and Killing Traditional Media. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back,
we'll explore the intersection of science and politics in the U.S.
Stay tuned.
How much longer will it?
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Throughout the past decade, intense battles have escalated over public policies to address public health and sustainability issues, including climate change. Within the policy argument, several important questions have arisen about the intersection of politics and science. How does one maintain the integrity of science? What about the politicization of science? How do democratic processes impact the work of science and public understandings? Three experts join us. Naomi Oreskes is professor of history and science studies at the University of California in San Diego. She is author of numerous publications, including The Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming. David Gustin is professor of political science and co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He is author of Between Politics and Science, Assuring the Integrity and Productivity of Research, and also co-author of Informed Legislatures, Coping with Science in a Democracy. Mark Brown is professor of government and political science at California State University at Sacramento. He is the author of Science in Democracy, Expertise, Institutions, and Representation.
David Gustin, in your book, you had a quote from Science and Reason arguing about how democracy depends on the use of reason. And if the integrity of science and reason are undermined among the majority, then democracy itself is in peril. Do you agree with this? And if so, why?
You're really starting with a tough one. I think that there's a close but sometimes problematic relationship between democracy and reason. And on the one hand, it's challenging to figure out how we get to a good, solid, robust democratic politics without a great deal of both reason and reasonableness. On the other hand, we have historical legacies of what had passed as reason and reasonableness that do not stand to our current democratic sentiments, and therefore we might want to scrutinize what currently stands as reason and reasonableness to see whether those can pass our democratic sentiments as well. If that's the case, then yes, we need reason and reasonableness, but we always need to be reflexive about what those things mean, try to understand them both historically and currently, and look beyond them to things that are values and sentiments as well.
And science itself, where does it play in, along with reason, reasonableness, and democracy?
Well, science is a critical component of liberal democratic societies in lots of different ways. It helps create the material basis for a good society. It provides, in many instances, a model of the application of reason and reasonableness that democracy can draw on for solving some political problems. But it's also an enterprise that is rather exclusive compared to our aspirations for democratic activities. And it operates in some ways that really don't stand a favorable comparison if we want to think about how we want democratic institutions to operate.
Naomi Oreskes.
I guess I have a slightly different view. I think reason is central to science, the evaluation of evidence, the evaluation of claims, the scrutiny, the critical scrutiny of claims is at the core of all scientific research. And I agree that science is essential for democracy in terms of giving us evidence about the natural world we live in, giving us some constraints. There are physical constraints on the world we live in. There are laws of physics and chemistry. There are material constraints. And science plays a crucial role in our understanding those constraints and understanding what they mean for how we live and how we operate. But when it comes to the political domain, I guess I've been pretty influenced by Drew Weston's work and just life experience. Politics really isn't about reason, not really. It's really about values, it's about feelings, it's about emotions, it's about the things we love and value the most. Most of us don't vote on principles of reason. We vote on principles of values, and we vote to protect the things we care about. And sometimes we even do that in highly irrational ways, because we don't always sort that out very well. But that's the reality of how people do behave. So I think it's really important for all of us who are in this kind of interface between science and politics to recognize that difference and to say that when it comes to politics, it isn't just about reason. I mean, we hope reason plays some role, but we know that it's a lot less than most of us egghead academics would like it to be. And we have to acknowledge that. And I think this is really where the scientific community faces a gigantic challenge. And I think it helps explain why the scientific community has been really rather ineffectual in communicating what it knows about the physical constraints, what it knows about the natural world, because scientists talk in the language of reason. They talk in the language of facts and numbers and figures and charts and graphs and all those things, but that just doesn't mean anything to most people. So the trick, and I think this is where, you know, we have a big challenge ahead of us, a challenge that we don't have a lot of time left to sort out on the issue of climate. The challenge is to take the facts of science, the physical constraints, the reason-based stuff that we know, and communicate that in ways that people understand emotionally and their value sense. And that means, in a way, translating the science into what it means for people. So one of the things I'm involved in right now, I join the board of directors of a group called Protect Our Winters, which is trying to mobilize the winter sports community on climate issues. And when we talk about what we're doing, we try to emphasize this is about protecting something that we love. It's about protecting winter sports that are so fun, about the incredible natural beauty of winter in the mountains, and really kind of tapping into people's love of nature, love of skiing. That's, in a way, the personal message. It comes from science, because science tells us that our winters are threatened, but we don't talk about it in the language of science.
Mark Brown.
I would agree with everything that Naomi and Dave just said, except perhaps what Naomi said about values, because I think it's important to remember that there are different kinds of reason, and there's scientific reason, which plays a big role in democratic politics, but people often make reasonable arguments about what's valuable, and in that sense, values are different than preferences. Sometimes I ask my students what kind of ice cream they prefer, and one says chocolate and the other says vanilla, and then I ask the first to persuade the second that chocolate is really better, and they can't.
Right.
Because that's a question of preference. But if I ask about whether the death penalty should be banned or whether we should spend more money to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, that's a question on which people can give reasons. And science is one kind of reason, but there are other reasons about moral responsibility and historical legacy and the kind of society we want to have. And I think democracy works best when you have a constant dialogue between different kinds of reasons on the one hand, and then people's preferences and desires on the other.
One of the things that I was hoping to get to with this discussion is where science and politics interact. I think something David Gustin has written about is this idea of science in the public interest, and that science is supposed to, as we idealize it, advance aspects of humanity. But there are, of course, all these places where science gets politicized, and then that ends up affecting politics and science together. Let's talk about the intersection and how this relationship has changed over time. David Gustin, why don't you start?
The challenge of talking about the politicization of science in part steps from what understanding of science we have to begin with and to what extent we believe that politics is, in fact, part of science. And I know that Mark and I have subtle disagreements over this. They're very subtle. But I tend to think of science as, in many ways, being political already. And so to talk about a politicization of science is not quite the right way to go, in my view. I mean, the ways that science is already political include the fact that science receives its resources, the ones that it operates with, through political means, that scientists use ways that we would recognize as very familiar in political institutions for making decisions that scientists believe are scientific decisions. So in lots of places, for example, scientists vote, and the result is something that's called science. And so the question to me is not really how do we not politicize science or how do we keep science from being politicized, but rather how it is that we democratize science because it's already politicized.
Naomi Oreskes, this is going to get batted to you partly because of your latest book, The Merchants of Doubt, in which you detail evidence that science and scientific evidence has been kind of turned on its head in the political process. And the result seems to be a public problem in terms of mostly health and sustainability.
Right. So this is an important point. As you say, this is essentially the topic of our book, Merchants of Doubt, which I wrote with Eric Conway. I think David's right that this is a subtle and complicated issue, and language and nuance does matter here. So I agree with David that the word politicization is somewhat problematic because, as David says, there is a way in which science is political, especially if the funding is coming from taxpayers. We support science for reasons which are at least in part political. So there's a way in which the word politicization isn't so helpful. So in a way, what I think about in a way is, I don't know, maybe less nuanced. One is political interference. I mean, we know that there are certain processes that go on within the scientific community, certain processes of evaluating evidence, judging claims, publishing them in literature that's peer-reviewed. And those processes, they've changed over time, but there's a certain kind of stability to at least a big chunk of them. And what we have seen in recent years on certain issues, such as climate change and other environmental issues like acid rain and the ozone hole that we talked about in our book, is really direct, overt, kind of vulgar political interference in that process, attempts to distort the peer review process. I mean, I feel the most important chapter in our book is the chapter on acid rain, actually not the chapter on climate change, because we were able to document in black and white with evidence, with historical documentation, the direct interference in the political peer review process. And because peer review is really at the crux of scientific evaluation of claims, that kind of interference, that kind of vulgar, overt interference is really deeply disturbing in democracy. Because if we can't count on peer-reviewed scientific evidence to be reliable because it's been messed with for political reasons, then we do have a deep, deep problem. So I think political interference is significant. And then the other thing we talk about, of course, are politically motivated attacks, which are camouflaged or disguised as scientific attacks. So this is, in a sense, the crux of our book that we show in a whole series of episodes over the last, 30, 40, 50 years, that one of the strategies that people have used in political debate in the United States is to attack science for reasons that are largely political, that have to do with values and interests and all those good, normal political things, but to disguise those attacks as if they were scientific debate. And that's a really toxic thing, both for science and for politics, because it makes it very hard for scientists to know how to respond, because they'd like to respond as scientists to legitimate scientific questions. So they're kind of hobbled when politics is disguised as science. And then it's really difficult for all of us in the rest of the world, because we'd like to know that the scientific information we're getting is accurate and reliable, so we could make those preference and value decisions that Mark was talking about. But if we think that the science is uncertain because people have convinced us of that for political reasons, then we're stuck in this horrible muddle that is really difficult to get out of.
Naomi Oreskes, with regards to what you just said, one is, you said because of politics or values, it seemed to me from the reading of your book that it was really more about money in most of these cases, the cigarette companies, for example, the fossil fuel industry, and not particularly values, that they were using scientific method to try to poke holes in the science.
Well, a lot of people have that reading of our book, and sometimes I feel like maybe this was a failure on our part. We didn't make this clear, although I thought we really did, but I think we were trying to say in the book that it was both money and values. It was money and ideology. Certainly money played a big role, particularly in the start of the story when the tobacco industry first gets involved in this story. For the tobacco industry, absolutely positively, it's about money. It's about the billions of dollars in profits vested in the tobacco industry. But part of what we thought was interesting about the story was that it wasn't just about money, because if it were just money, it wouldn't have explained why you get prominent scientists who participate in this activity. So what we showed in the book, what we tried to explain, was that there's also this strong ideological component that's driven by the defense of free market capitalism. And it's that ideological component that helps to explain why all kinds of people make common cause with the tobacco industry, people who you wouldn't think on the face of it would think that the tobacco industry was their friend.
Mark Brown, in your book, you looked at the historic perspective of science and politics and also a little bit of a comparative perspective. How do you see this interaction now, and where does it seem like it's going?
I think that Dave Gustin's right that in some sense science is always organized in a political way, and politics is one of those words that people always mean and use in different ways, so it's sometimes hard to know how people are using it. But it's certainly true historically that science has been shaped by politics, but when it works best, it's shaped in such a way that it is simultaneously somewhat insulated from politics. And that's where I completely agree with Naomi's concerns about the way that science has been subject to partisan manipulation, and maybe partisan influence would be more clear than political influence. And that's a major problem, because it makes it impossible for science to inform politics. But at the same time, I think we have to also turn the question around and ask, well, what's the best way for science to influence politics? To not just look at the influence of politics on science, but also ask, well, how should science influence politics? And I think historically, and especially in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a really strong effort to try to have science speak with a single voice and try to provide decisive answers to political questions. And I think that often backfires, because then it makes it very easy to undermine the political case for some policy goal by simply attacking the science. If science is offered as the main justification for doing something, then you're practically inviting people to attack the science.
Does democracy sometimes interfere with science when, say, if people don't understand science and they elect representatives who don't understand science, then do those representatives discount the science without understanding it? Dave Gustin, maybe we should throw that to you.
Let me start off by saying, I have been arguing for the democracy side of it, but it's also the case that we have an imperfect democracy. We don't live in a society, and I don't think perhaps anyone on the planet lives in a society that they would call a perfect political democracy. And a lot of the flaws of our democracy seem to correspond with many of the flaws in the relationship between politics and science that we've been talking about. I love Naomi's work, and this is a question that sort of about it that arises for me, is the bulk of the cure for these pathologies that are documented around climate issues in particular, is the cure for this a situation where, on the one hand, as many in the scientific community pose, one where scientists have more influence, where more scientists are elected to public office, where we are held to higher standards in including sound science or the best available science in our regulatory and administrative decisions, or, and maybe it's not an or, maybe it's an and or, the cure to this in trying to figure out how large, wealthy, partial institutions like the tobacco lobby play a smaller role in the way we deliberate?
That's a very good question.
I think the Coke question of the cure is extremely complicated, and since Dave's read the book, he knows that at the end we don't really try to suggest a cure because that would have been a whole different book. But I certainly don't think the cure is simply to have more scientists in control. I don't think history really supports that. Scientists are good at doing what they do, which is science. And I think that to the extent that we can think about social or regulatory reforms, those reforms should be as much as possible in a realistic way to allow scientists to do science as much as possible, protected from gross overt interference. And it doesn't mean that the funding shouldn't be highly scrutinized by the democratic process. It doesn't mean that the topics on which scientists work on shouldn't be highly scrutinized. They should be in a democracy, in any environment. But when scientists are evaluating data to the extent that it's possible to protect them from political interference, and then the whole issue of funding, and, you know, we've talked already about the tobacco industry. I mean, there are some fairly simple things that you could think about. There's a lot of good industrial funding of science. We wouldn't want to say that just the fact of industrial funding is necessarily a bad thing. But there are certain kinds of protections that a person could imagine. So in my own university, it's pretty easy to say, look, it's fine to take money from industry so long as you're free to publish the results no matter where the chips fall. The problem starts arising when people, for example, at the medical school have agreements with pharmaceutical companies to fund research, but if the research is not favorable to the drug or if the research reveals bad side effects, that data can't be published. That's the serious problem, and we know that kind of thing goes on. So I think one wants to think about those kinds of mechanisms to protect scientists, to be able to do good science, to make sure good science is published. I also think, I mean, I've thought a lot about industrial research. There's a lot of data in industry that's relevant to public safety and health that we can't get hold of because it's considered trade secrets. But if those things are about products that are on the market, one could imagine a regulatory structure that makes it illegal to hide scientific information that has, you know, public health consequences. So, again, one could think about political strategies, but I don't think what we want to say is, oh, we need more scientists, you know, in public office. The historical track record of scientists and engineers as presidents, we have to say, is not that great, right?
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We are speaking with
Naomi Oreskes, Professor of History and Science Studies at the University of California in San Diego. Mark Brown, Professor of Government and Political Science at California State University at Sacramento. David Gustin, Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University.
So we have a couple of things on the table here. One is scientific integrity and protecting that. One is, of course, this role of experts and the role of democratic laypersons and representatives. Where are we headed now with some of this in the public? David, thank you for the poll that showed the public really wanting scientific debate. And at the same time, we see a lot of decisions on local levels trying to strip science out of public schools or balancing it with things that are not scientific, such as religion. Mark Brown, that was a long treatise. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's fine. We have a lot of issues here. I could say something more about the whole question of public understanding of science. It's certainly an important piece of the puzzle, but I think oftentimes in these discussions it becomes overemphasized. And I think it's useful to distinguish between scientific knowledge that's politically relevant and that is actually necessary for people to get involved, and knowledge that's not so relevant. The latest numbers I saw, 25% of Americans don't know that the Earth goes around the sun, and I think that's unfortunate, and it should be changed, but it's not going to mean the downfall of democracy. And what research also shows is that scientific knowledge is not actually the most important factor that shapes whether or not people get involved in environmental issues, for example. It's one factor, but more important is people's knowledge of how the political process works and of where they can get involved, and their knowledge and understanding of the politics of science rather than scientific facts taken in an isolated way. And we so often see these worrying studies about what the public knows and doesn't know about science, but I'd like to see a lot more attention given to what the public knows and doesn't know about the politics of science and about how they can get involved, because that's really what shapes whether people do get involved or not.
David Gustinem.
One way of taking Mark's comments about getting people involved and interested in the parts of science and the politics of science that are relevant to them is to have really sort of important, provocative public discussions about those things. And I'm part of a group called Science Debate that has been agitating to do just that, to have the presidential candidates engage in face-to-face, publicly televised debates about science and science policy issues. And in 2008, before I was part of the group, they succeeded in having candidates Obama and McCain address in print a series of 14 questions, the answers to which the campaigns published in Science magazine. But the ultimate goal is to get in a face-to-face debate to talk about science and science policy issues. And there's a public opinion poll that's been circulating that Science Debate was part of that suggests that this is what the American public would like to see also, more so than debates about, for example, faith.
Naomi Oreskes, we saw in the polls when people are asked if they'd like to see the science more in the debates are very high. We also saw in the polls a big drop in the public's confidence in science and scientists after ClimateGate.
Right. It's really, in a way, heartening to know that people are interested in science and would like to hear about how it affects their lives. And that suggests that scientists can play a role in public debate by getting out into the community, talking to people, talking about what they know and how these things are relevant to people's lives. I think Mark is right that it's not about the fact. It's not so much that the problem is that people don't know that the Earth goes around the sun. Although I have to say, I do find that kind of alarming, because if it seems like if they don't know that, then we're really starting at a pretty basic level. It tells us that at minimum we have a heck of a lot of work to do. But at the end of the day, it isn't so much about the facts. I think it's about the process. To me, the efficacy of the stolen email affair, the fact that certain things taken out of context had such power and potency, shows that people really don't understand how science works at all. Yeah, the issue of recalcitrant data is a really great one. I teach it all the time because it's a great way to show students how scientists deal with evidence and to show students how the scientific process works. But the fact that that was taken out of context in a way to discredit science, when actually it's the credit of science that they grapple with data in this really rigorous way, really tells us that the American people have no idea what scientists actually do, how they work, how the process operates, what the outcomes are. I mean, it is a messy process. It is like sausage making. Seeing what actually goes into it is kind of, in a way, horrible. You know, and scientists are people like everybody else. They get jealous and they get angry and they say stupid things. But somehow out of that process, we still get reliable knowledge. So I guess my message would be that if the scientific community is going out to talk about these issues, it's extremely important not to just get super hung up on the facts, not to get hung up on how many watts per meter squared we've added to the atmospheric radiative balance, but rather to talk about how do we know these things? How do we know that climate change isn't just caused by the sun? Because we do know that. We have really robust data that tells us that greenhouse gases are driving climate change. In fact, we have really robust data. Climate change would be worse were it not for other pollutants in the atmosphere. But I find when I speak in public, people are really, really interested in that. And people are incredibly grateful when I explain to them, you know, how we know it's not volcanoes. And that would be my message to the scientific community. Get out there and talk more about how we know these things, not just what we know.
I could just add one thing to that. That would also come back to Dave's original comment about science being political. I think Naomi's right that there needs to be more talk about the process of science. But that then also has to include discussion of the political and social process, how science gets funded, the role that it plays in politics, should science give decisive recommendations or present a range of options? And those are also parts of the process of science. And I think if we're going to have more public trust in science advice, scientists need to be much more transparent and open about those elements of the scientific process as well.
Yeah, but if I could add one thing on that, the problem with that is that a lot of scientists themselves don't actually know. So I think that's actually where people like us come in. Political scientists, historians of science, philosophers, people who have studied those processes, we also need to get out and talk about that as well.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you all. Naomi Oreskes is Professor of History and Science Studies at the University of California in San Diego. She is author of numerous publications, including The Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming. David Gustin is Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He is author of Between Politics and Science, Assuring the Integrity and Productivity of Research. Mark Brown is Professor of Government and Political Science at California State University at Sacramento. He is the author of Science in Democracy, Expertise, Institutions, and Representation.
That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at Armudian. We'll see you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives needs your help so we can restore and preserve another of our 55,000 reel-to-reel tapes in our collection.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand year old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.